We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Today we have a special guest for you. It is Larry Kuhn, author of the NBA Collective Bargaining Agreement FAQ and a writer for ESPN.com and the New York Times, and also possibly the next coach of the Los Angeles Lakers if they're following his Twitter feed. Larry,
yeah,
thanks for coming on.
I was making my little campaign for that there. Glad you saw it.
Yeah, we noticed, and I don't know if you could do much worse than poor Mike Brown.
You know, and it is a poor, I mean, a sad thing, just because, you know, as a person, I just really like Mike Brown a lot. You can't find a nicer guy in the NBA, probably can't find a harder worker as a coach, but, you know, results speak, and especially in Los Angeles, and an 08 preseason followed by a 1-4 start to the regular season. And they're looking at it and they're saying, I don't see this getting any better, you know, despite the injuries that happened. The team's sort of lost in this sort of half Princeton, half not Princeton offense and really not getting on the same page. And Mitch Kupchak decided and Jerry Buss and Jim Buss decided that this is time to get something done. You could even, if you want to spin it a certain way, you can even say, you know, they're entering a homestand now. It's going to be a soft part of the schedule because a lot of the games are going to be easy. We better fire him now because he could start winning here, and then there goes our excuse.
Right, and a big part of the thing in LA, and I guess what we're seeing around the league is the Lakers just went out, even with you know, the luxury tax payments about to get punitive in another year. They went out, they put $100 million into payroll this season. And I guess my first question for you, just on a general note, is we have almost a year now into this new CBA. We have a shortened season, but a season nonetheless behind us, and a summer and a draft that saw teams set themselves up for the next couple of years. What, if anything, have you noticed that this new CBA has done with regard to how GMs are putting together their teams or thinking long term?
Yeah, the CBA is going to change the finances of the league, and there's no question about that. And it's already starting to happen. You had certain teams that are really being proactive. You have guys like Mark Cuban who are saying, we see this coming, and that affected their decision on whether or not to keep Tyson Chandler. You have teams like Oklahoma City this year where they're looking at their payroll next year and saying, this is going to be $100 million going out to to our team, and we're sort of a victim of our own success here. You know, these are guys we drafted, we developed. We don't have a single bad contract on this roster, but we still can't afford to keep it. We're in the 20th biggest market in the league, $100 million contract. Next year, we're going to be talking about, you know, $185 million or so in salary plus tax, and we just can't do that. So they had to sacrifice Harden because of that. On the flip side, you're seeing teams like the Lakers and probably the Knicks saying, you know, we don't really care how punitive it is because we have so much revenue coming in. We can afford to keep this going. We're a free, because we're big markets, we're New York and LA, we are free agent meccas. We are the glamour teams, and we're going to be able to attract guys. So they're in a different mode of operation. They're in, hey, let's spend it mode. And then once this current run runs its course, they just wipe the roster and then start spending all over again, which is something that the small market teams that aren't real free agent destinations can't really do. So the Lakers and the Knicks could be in a position where they can start cleaning up on players that other teams just can't afford to keep.
So the question I've had is has it really impacted the league that much? Because it always seemed to me like the small markets were kind of frugal and the big markets spent like crazy, and they put this extra punitive level of, you know, extra money, and it goes up, and then there's the repeat offenders who get even more charged to them. But in the end, it still seems like there's like those five teams that really don't care.
Well, exactly.
And everybody else.
Right, because one of the things that the league tried to do with the lockout was to try to make it a true level playing field. If you remember the league's negotiating position, you know, at the start of the lockout, they wanted a $48 million hard cap where teams had no opportunity to spend above that. They obviously didn't get that, but that's something that really would have leveled the playing field. You know, what we have now is sort of an offshoot of what the CBA was before. You know, you have a soft cap, you have a luxury tax. It's more punitive now, so it's going to cost more money, and in some cases a lot more money. But if the team has enough revenue coming in that they're willing to spend, they can do it. You know, on the flip side, there's the small market teams, the guys in the markets like, you know, Oklahoma City and Minneapolis, places like that, where they're saying, we can't afford, you know, we don't have the revenue coming in where we can sustain this sort of spending model for a roster that the big market teams can do. We need some help. We just can't do it. So they came up with a revenue sharing system. But even that only went part of the way because there's caps on receipts. There's caps on spending. So that a team like the Lakers, you know, they're projected to spend $50 million next season, you know, 49.4, I think it was, in the revenue sharing next year. But that gets split a lot of different ways. So no one team has really helped a lot. You know, a team might get $10, $15 million at the most, but that's really not going to make a team like, you know, a Minneapolis competing on a level playing field with a team like the Lakers. And, you know, even if you look at a team like Oklahoma City, they're actually slated to be spending a little bit in revenue sharing. They're the 28th biggest market, and they're net payers. They're not net receivers, which is one of the reasons that they made the decision on James Harden that they did.
So, I mean, and this is the funny thing, is that the Hornets right now are in, it seems like year one of a rebuild, and after watching what happened in Oklahoma City, Hornets fans are already a little afraid that what if Davis does become, you know, the star that it looks like he's going to be, and Austin Rivers actually takes off as well, then the Hornets could be in a position in 3 or 4 years where they can't afford to pay Gordon, Davis, Rivers, and Anderson. I mean, do you see that this is going to be a problem going forward with small markets, that even if they do build through the draft in Oklahoma City Thunder type of way, that eventually they're just going to have to sell off their pieces, you know, to other teams? Or do you think that perhaps with, you know, the more punitive luxury tax, that maybe salaries come down a little bit? I mean, I think a Ty Lawson getting $12 million a year, where maybe he could have got a max contract in the old CBA. I mean, could we see that across the board where the guys who aren't max players actually don't get paid like max players as opposed to the Rudy Gays that we saw in the last CBA?
Yeah, you're going to see a little bit of that. And you're already starting to see that to a certain extent, sort of this bifurcation of the players in the league, where the max guys are the true max guys, and everybody else is you know, they're getting a lot less than the max. And even some guys that under the previous agreement would have been a mid-level contractor above are getting the minimum salary this year. You know, Anton Jameson is one example with the Lakers. But the money, like from the revenue, from the luxury tax is really only going to go so far, like I said, because it gets split so many different ways. So the pattern that you're going to see is exactly what you talked about with Oklahoma City. They drafted, you know, four guys, developed them, and now they're at the point in their careers where they're through with their rookie contracts and they're ready to get paid, and their salary is, you know, up there over $10 million. You know, even if salaries do come down, okay, instead of, you know, Serge Ibaka being a max contract guy, he's a $12.5 million contract guy. But, you know, that's enough when you're talking about four guys who are making over $10 million a year. One, you know, way of terming the new model, some people are saying no more than two guys with eight-figure salaries, for example. So Oklahoma City and then possibly New Orleans in the future just can't afford to sustain that kind of market. So you're going to see a small market model that, in order to be sustainable, looks to recycle some of these assets. They're investing their money in the draft. They're investing their money in player development. They're investing their money, you know, even in the D League, and they're trying to develop players and keep them while they're cheap. And then once they get expensive, what they're going to do is cash them in. They're going to trade them like Oklahoma City traded James Harden to Houston. You know, they got Kmart for, you know, a 1 year stopgap to sort of fill in kind of the same scoring role that Harden provided. But the real thing that they got out of that trade was Jeremy Lamb, who's, you know, a lottery pick this year. They got a couple of first round draft picks and a second for the future. So they're reinvesting those players into assets, because if you're investing in development through the draft and through player development, you need those chips to be able to throw into that process. So you need as many draft picks as you can possibly get. And that's what Oklahoma City did. They cashed in Harden for a lot of draft picks, and then that's going to hopefully make this whole process sustainable for them. New Orleans might be in the same position in a couple of years. If everybody develops, you know, like, you know, Rivers and Davis, like you were saying, they could be in the same spot in a couple of years and be faced with some of the same choices.
So one of the things New Orleans did this offseason, or, you know, I guess preseason, was they declined the options on Xavier Henry and Al-Farouq Aminu, the rookie options for their fourth year. Now, Henry, it's not surprising he hasn't been able to really do anything, but Aminu is somebody who still might be seen as somebody with potential. He's had some good games to start the season. So the question is, they've declined the option. So they can't have him under contract next year automatically. What options do they have with Aminu? If he continues to play well, or even just well enough that he's obviously growing, so maybe we should keep him around. What can Dell Demps do to make keep him?
Yeah. So let's say they do decide that they want to keep him. So his history in the league, you know, he was the eighth pick of the 2010 draft. So he got one of those rookie scale contracts. It's 2 years plus two team option years. They picked up that first option year, declined the last option year. So after 3 years, he becomes a free agent. He's going to be a full bird free agent. But this is a special case because there's a rule where a team can't decline that option year like they did with him and then let him become a free agent and then use the full bird rights to give him any amount, you know, up to the maximum. With a case like this, they're limited, using the bird exception, to giving him no more than he would have gotten had they picked up the option. So it's still using their bird rights. So it would preserve, you know, if they were above the cap and had the mid-level exception, for example, it would preserve that. They would be able to spend using the bird exception, but the amount is limited. So if they had picked up the option, his bump in the fourth year would have been 27.2% above what he's making this year. So instead of, you know, 2.947 this year, he would have gotten, you know, 3.749 million next year. They can re-sign him as a free agent next summer, but they can't re-sign him using bird rights for more than that 3.749 in the first year. So, you know, what are their other possibilities for keeping him? It depends on if they end up being a cap room team or not, and they probably will end up being a cap room team, obviously. So with cap room, they can give them any amount up to the cap, up to the amount of cap room that they have. So if they have, $15 million under the cap and want to give it all to Al Farouk, they can certainly do that. If they're above the cap or, you know, close enough to it and they have their exceptions like the mid-level, the mid-level exception this next summer is going to be $5.15 million. They could give that to him. You know, with cap room, they could spend it on other guys, and then there's that new room exception that teams get when they have cap room and then spend up to the cap. That's going to be $2.652 million next year. So I would imagine that they would offer him some amount of cap room, and then they'll see what the market dictates. They'll see, you know, who has interest in him and what are the teams are willing to pay.
And another thing that I'm interested about in this new CBA, if it's still there, I was surprised that more teams didn't use this in the last one, but Nick Collison had a really interesting deal with Oklahoma City in the last CBA, where essentially in the final year of his deal, Oklahoma City had cap room, gave him, I guess you could call it a signing bonus of sorts, that took up their cap room from that year, but then had very minimal amounts on their cap in the following years for Nick Collison. This is why we see such a good player on such a small deal. The Hornets have next year, Jason Smith will be in the final year of his deal. Let's say the Hornets don't use any of their cap room. They go into the season with a $8 to $9 million in cap room available. Can they work a similar deal with Jason Smith, or has the new CBA kind of made that harder to do? What are kind of the constraints on doing a deal like that?
Yeah, the short answer is going to be no, they can't. But let me explain the whole thing. So when you talk about the Nick Collison extension, normally when an extension has a signing bonus, what they do is the bonus gets paid as soon as the extension takes effect. So you have an extension that you sign now that takes effect next summer. Next summer he receives that signing bonus, and it's just like any signing bonus at a new contract where the bonus is paid for out of the extension dollars, and therefore the base salary gets reduced in order to advance the salary. But if the team has cap room when they sign the extension, they have the option of paying the signing bonus right away. And then instead of coming out of the extension, the signing bonus comes out of that cap room. And they technically consider that to be a renegotiation in order to get that salary up there. So that preserves the full extension for, you know, the extension, and then also throws extra dollars from the cap room. That sort of thing does still exist in the CBA, but here's the thing that keeps it from working with Smith. Smith signed a three-year contract, and three-year contracts can't be extended. You have to have at least a four-year contract in order to extend it.
Mm. That's depressing.
Yeah.
We are so hopeful. Well, let's move on to somebody else. Good old buddy Eric Gordon, whose heart is probably still in Phoenix. He signed that massive contract with the Hornets. He's been basically sent to L.A. to work on personalized rehab, which is a very, very strange thing. Typically, people don't get sent home unless there's some other reason than injury. We kind of fully expect him to be traded this year. So if they manage to trade, and I don't know if he's going to be even worth anything near this with, you know, with his history, but if they manage to grab somebody like, say, Brandon Jennings, one of these guys who didn't get an extension this year where they were eligible to, they're right at the end, so they're going to be getting a new contract next year anyways. Can they renegotiate with someone like Brandon Jennings right away and sign him for an extension before July 1st, or do they have to wait until free agency starts before they can do anything with that player?
Yeah, we missed the window of opportunity on that one because he's one of the guys on a rookie deal, and he's coming off the last season of that. Those contracts had to be extended by October 31st of the year before they become a free agent. So unlike a regular contract that could be extended right up until June 30th, you know, the day before the guy becomes a free agent, guys on rookie deals, you need to make that decision a lot earlier. That's why you saw James Harden traded when he was. It was like, you know, October 29th or 30th. And that gave Houston the window of opportunity to sign him to the extension themselves. So with Jennings and everybody else who didn't get an extension by October 31st, that ship has sailed. They're going to become a free agent next summer, and a team really can't do anything about that. So, yeah, with Eric Gordon, it's sort of an interesting case because, you know, you don't know the status of his health and whether he really is going to come back or he's going to be plagued by injuries forevermore. So he's getting paid a lot of money, you know, 13.6 this year, 14.3 next year, 14.9 the year after that, and then he has an option for 15.5 the year after that. So when you talk about trade value for a guy whose health is questionable making that much money under the current CBA, that might be a tough sell.
Yeah, we're kind of looking at the reality of Eric Gordon as if we can get back a bag of potato chips or something like the Baron Davis deal a few years ago where they traded him for a year of Speedy Claxton and Dale Davis's corpse.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, another team in a similar situation maybe might be the Knicks with Amari Stoudemire, where, you know, you don't know what you're going to get out of him in the future. Or, you know, even if you do get somebody who can play, whether he's going to have the explosiveness that sort of earned him that big contract to begin with. But the difference, though, is the Knicks are one of those teams where, you know, the MSG Corporation, you know, so the Knicks and the arena and the network are all rolled up into one big, huge money-making package, and they really don't care if they're spending that much money on Amari Stoudemire. They have the revenue coming in where they're saying, you know, if this works out, we can afford to put together a team that's going to win. If it doesn't work out, well, okay, we have to eat Amari's contract, but we can afford to do that. We're still going to be a profitable corporation, you know, when you talk about the larger corporations. So they can afford to make mistakes like that. The Hornets really can't afford to make those sorts of mistakes. If a team like the Hornets has a, you know, $15 million per year albatross on their roster, that's really going to hurt them.
So John Hollinger pointed this out about a week ago, and if you look across the landscape in the upcoming free agent class after we had all these extensions, there's maybe three, four, five guys that you could talk yourself into being those $10 million plus players that you're saying that teams want two of at the max. Maybe Josh Smith, maybe Brandon Jennings, players like that. But there's going to be 10, 12, 13, 14 teams out there with salary cap room to give guys huge contracts. What do you anticipate this summer? Do you think that teams make the old classic mistake of overpaying, or do you think that teams with these new punitive penalties coming up are going to stay relatively frugal and only three or four teams really spend their money on a big acquisition this summer?
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about that myself. Just because, you know, this is really the first year where, you like you said, we get the punitive luxury tax and things are really going to start costing teams when they make a mistake. You know, there's a lot of good free agents coming up this year, but for the most part, all of them, you know, there's some baggage that comes along with them. You know, you talk about an Andrew Bynum, who's, you know, possibly a franchise-level center, but he's got the injury history. You know, Manu Ginobili, you know, another guy who's getting up in years who might have commanded a big contract, but you know, he's older and he has an injury history, and he might not. Guys like that, guys like Steph Curry, guys like, you know, guys like Bynum, are guys that maybe don't justify such a big contract logically, but it's still the law of supply and demand. You've got, you know, a limited talent pool, a very rare talent pool, and you've got 30 franchises, a lot of whom have dollars to spend, and these GMs are under the gun. They need to improve their roster, and they might be willing to take that risk, even with the punitive luxury tax. I think it's going to take owners coming in and saying, because they have the final approval almost everywhere, where the owners have to sign off on the team spending this kind of money. You know, there are some franchises where the GM asks the owner for permission to spend X amount of money, and the decision on yes is going to come back right away. It's like, yeah, we got the money, we trust you, go for it. There's other franchises where the owner's going to step in and say, hey, we can't do that. So if something is going to save the leak from itself this time, it's going to be the owner stepping in and doing that, sort of being cognizant of the fact that revenue sharing is going on, and you know, they might be payers in that, the luxury tax is there, and a mistake can really cost the franchise going forward. So it could go either way. I think it's a coin flip at this point. So that's why I said I'm interested to see what happens, because I can't tell you for sure which way it's going to go.
So I'd be remiss. This will be my final one. I'll be remiss if I don't ask you. I'm sure you get these all the time. Everybody thinks they're smarter than these owners and players who negotiated this CBA. To me, I know some believe it was just rhetoric that they were trying to sell us, that they were trying to level the playing field. I actually believe that both sides wanted to do that. So my CBA proposal, after seeing what happened with Oklahoma City, is very simple. I want to know which side you think would have said no. Essentially, everything stays exactly the same, except if you drafted a player and then, you know, therefore sign them, extend them, they only count 80% towards your luxury tax bill. So teams like Oklahoma City, who draft, develop, and put the time and money into developing their own players, they don't have to face a James Harden situation because, you know, they shouldn't. For a team like the Lakers that goes out and just acquires everybody else's talent after they've been overpaid and so on and so forth, you know, they're still count against this punitive luxury tax and have to pay for it. Which side do you think would have said no to that small tweak in the CBA?
You know, I don't know if a proposal like that was discussed. I know that they talked about all sorts of different things. You know, I think that that's a reasonable type of thing for exactly the reason you named. It penalizes the teams that go out and just try to buy talent and therefore drive the prices up, but helps out the small market teams like the Oklahoma Cities. I think that the players would have been all for it, first of all, because that lowers the amount of money that teams are spending and therefore, in theory, frees up more money for more and bigger contracts for the players. So anything that helps the players get more money, the Players Association is going to be all for. You know, as far as the teams, I would think, you know, just like with revenue sharing itself, you know, this is something that hurts teams like the Lakers and the Knicks and the Bulls because they're spending a ton of money in this. You know, the Lakers actually voted yes on it because they recognize that the effect it's going to have on the global health of the league, and they realize that they're all in this together. You know, small market teams obviously are going to be all for it. If you're Oklahoma City, you're voting yes on something like that in a heartbeat because of exactly what you saw. So, you know, which makes me go back to wonder, did they actually discuss something like this? Because I would think that for the most part, that would be something that they would be able to negotiate through. You know, I like the ability for rules that promote the ability for teams to retain their own guys. A franchise tag is another example of that, where if you draft a guy, you develop him, and he's the centerpiece of your franchise, you know, like LeBron James was in Cleveland. And, you know, your whole marketing, your whole everything is built around the one guy. You know, yes, you have to respect the rights of players to move from team to team, which they fought hard for and, you know, they cling to, you know, greatly. But on the other hand, there are compromises to that. There's restricted free agency. And I thought that a franchise tag would have been a good idea, where if a team develops a player, he's going to become a free agent, he's a centerpiece of the franchise, and they're willing to spend the absolute max to keep him, they should have that right to retain him, because free agency has to be viewed as big market friendly. You know, the free agents tend to gravitate, you know, move from the small markets to the big markets. And, you know, even in the current CBA, you know, that's happening. What are the big deals that are going on? You know, Chris Paul, the first deal, went from New Orleans to Los Angeles. Dwight Howard went from Orlando to Los Angeles. So, you know, the pattern is still clear and it still exists in the current agreement. I like the ability for you know, I think that they blew it with the extension rules, for example, because you want to be able to prevent a player from becoming a free agent because a free agent is going to gravitate to a bigger market. So the rules for extensions are that they're limited to 4 years, but that includes any years that exist on the current contract. So if you extend a guy on June 30th, you know, the day before the year ends, the current year still counts as 1 year, and you can really only go 3 years. Well, 3 years as an extension versus 5 years as a free agent is sort of a no-brainer for a guy, especially if they're, you know, that late and that close to free agency. So of course they're going to become a free agent. And then when you take the set of players that become free agents, a percentage of those are going to be lost to bigger market teams. So I think that preventing that by allowing teams to extend players where there's no penalty to the player for extending rather than when he could become a free agent would have been a good thing and would have been one of, you know, met one of the goals that they were looking to meet, but they didn't do that either. So I thought there were lots of ways they could have done the CBA better. But, you know, the CBA is a compromise. It's both sides pulling in different directions, eventually coming up with something that's going to work, and an agreement happens, you know, at 2 a.m. after a 36-hour negotiating session, and maybe they're not totally thinking straight, but mainly thinking about, okay, what's going to get this done? So, you know, is it the greatest holistic agreement that they could have possibly come up with? No. But it's an organic process, not a holistic one, and it comes up with something that works, even though it doesn't work as well as you would hope it would.
Yeah. I have one question for you, and you kind of brought it up in that last statement. So it's the extension rules and how it is kind of hurting that the 3 years is essentially your maximum extension you could do as long as somebody's still under contract. And I'm sure there are some listeners from this podcast who are like sitting up like, wait a second, because Anthony Davis, you know, he is the franchise player. And let's assuming he is a max player, that he ends up being the franchise player everybody says he's going to be. When his contract reaches the point in his fourth year, he's going to either become a restricted free agent the next year or the Hornets have those options to go ahead and try to extend him. If they wanted to, and he's amenable, if they wanted to lock him up for the longest amount of maximum time at a maximum contract, what is their best option? Do they let him become a restricted free agent, then negotiate with him, or can they sign something before?
Yeah, that 3 year limit, you know, the 4 year limit, that effectively becomes 3 years because of counting the current years, really only applies to veteran extensions. For guys on rookie free agent contracts, the rules are a little bit different. Those are the ones that have to be extended by October 31st of the fourth, you know, year of that guy's contract. But they have the option of going 4 years. And in fact, they have the option of designating one guy who they can give 5 years to. So I believe the Hornets have not designated somebody up to this point. So they're free to offer Davis a 5 year extension, you know, if he meets certain, performance benchmarks, you know, if he becomes the MVP or is named to the, All-Star game, become an All-Star starter twice or an All-NBA team twice, then he can even qualify for a higher maximum salary, get that 7 to 9 year maximum rather than the 0 to 6 year maximum. So as long as the team and the player are open, you know, and in agreement on a big extension for a guy coming off of a rookie contract, then they can still do that. If the player doesn't want it, then what he can do is turn down that extension. He's still a restricted free agent, so the team can put up a qualifying offer, make him restricted, and then the player can, you know, try and sign somewhere else, but the team has the ability to match the contract and retain him. So if he goes out and signs a 4 year deal somewhere else, the Hornets can just say, okay, we're matching that, and then we got you under those terms for those 4 years. So players that want to get out, you know, let's say they just hate the team and they just want to escape as soon as possible, they turn down an extension to become a free agent after the fourth year, then they sign that 1 year qualifying offer. That becomes a 1 year contract, and then the guy leaves as a free agent the following year. One guy who did that, for example, would be Ben Gordon, who went from the Pistons, from the Bulls to the Pistons by doing that. So, you know, the Hornets are in a good situation there. The player really has to be willing to sacrifice in order to get away. But another sort of middle, you know, the thing that players sometimes do is, for example, LeBron James and Chris Bosh did that, where they did sign that extension after the fourth year, but they signed a shorter extension. They became free agents after that seventh year where the maximum salary kicks up, and then they leave. So, you know, in that case, the team gets the player for 7 years instead of, you know, a maximum of 9 years. So you're talking somewhere in that range, 5 to 7 to 9 years, where you're going to be able to keep the guy, depending on how willing he is to stay with the team.
And I know I said I had the last one, but Hornets fans would kill me if I ask you this. Going back to Eric Gordon, a lot of fans believe that he's faking this injury, that he's, you know, still doesn't want to be in New Orleans. Is there any loophole in the CBA? I know the Hornets can't use the amnesty. If I'm not mistaken, they could use the stretch provision, but that would just kill this cap for the next, what would it be, 7 years. Is there anything, if he refuses to play, is there any loophole, or they could take him to court, or any way that they could possibly void this contract under any condition? Or let's say he's Brandon Roy and he chooses to retire. I mean, is there any way the Hornets could get out of this $15 million on the cap every year if this just continues to progress?
Yeah, when I hear stuff like that, part of me just says, you know, is there really evidence for him faking it rather than him really being injured? And I don't know that there really is positive evidence. I think you could, if you have that conclusion in mind already, you can view any evidence in that light and you know, sort of twist it into becoming evidence for your theory. But that really doesn't make it true objective evidence that this is going on. And I really don't know many NBA players who would really do something like that just in order to try and force a trade. You know, people have done some things that were, you know, sort of, you know, strange. You know, Shaquille O'Neal, for example, was docking it by getting surgery right before the training camp started rather than, you know, the beginning of the off season. And his famous, you know, infamous quote on that was that he was going to heal on company time. You know, there's been little things like that, but a guy wanting to force his way to another team by playing an injury to be worse than it really is, I don't think really happens a lot. But let's say that he does do that, and the Hornets would have to be able to make the case that he is healthy and able to play, and he's just choosing not to. And with injuries, that's a thing that's, you know, it's tough to prove. Injuries can be so subtle in nature. You know, he would have doctors who are saying, yes, he is risking playing by doing this. You know, they could appeal it. They could go to an independent expert who could say that he's doing it. But that's a lot to go through for a really risky proposition of being able to say, hey, you got to play. So I really don't see it going down that way. Now let's look at the other situation where he really is injured, he can't play, and it's a Brandon Roy situation where he's going to retire because of the condition. Now if that happens, if he voluntarily gives up the salary by retiring, then the Hornets are off the book. If a player and a team agree to walk away from each other, agree to a divorce because of the injury, then and not give the player any money, then the team's off the hook. But typically in cases like this, the player wants to keep getting paid. Sometimes they'll come up with a buyout agreement. So that money would continue to count against the team's cap. Now, if it is what's considered to be a career-ending injury, then after a year, the team can petition the league to have the salary removed from the books. And, you know, that happens from time to time. And including sometimes the player sort of proves the doctor wrong and comes back, like, you know, Darius Miles did, then the salary goes right back on the book. So there are opportunities for things like that, but those don't happen all that often either. The worst case that the team can be in is that the player is not injured enough for it to be career ending. In other words, he's still making his money, but he's nowhere near the player he used to be. You know, when the team signed the guy to the big contract, he can no longer justify that salary. But the salary is not contingent upon him performing at a certain level. It's contingent upon him playing, period. So if he goes out there and he's a, you know, 20-minute guy and he's scoring 6, 8, 10 points a game, well, then they're stuck.
Oh, doomsday. All right. Well, and on a positive note, as always, whenever we talk Eric Gordon on this podcast.
Yeah. he's kind of got us going to buy it. So, I mean, basically, we just got to hope that he's injured and that he's going to come back and suddenly not be injured again, even though his history says he's going to be injured a lot.
Yeah, I mean, what's the potential? But you know, you also have to look at it, you know, in terms of did they make a wise move in trading for him in the first place and in matching that contract? You know, because the Clippers certainly look at it that way, you know, in the Chris Paul trade. They've told me one of the reasons that they did this trade and they were happy to throw Gordon in was the fact that he was going to demand a really high salary and he's already developing an injury history and they didn't think it was a wise investment. So, you know, the Hornets had two opportunities there. They had the opportunity when they had him, you know, thrown into the trade in the first place. And you can say that one was low risk because he was just going to be a free agent. And he was somebody where if it worked out great, they resign him. You know, and if not, then they don't, and they let him walk. But, you know, then they had a second opportunity when Phoenix signed him to decide whether to match or not. And you know, I don't know if they really took his injury history seriously enough when they made the decision to match that contract.
Yeah, we were kind of thinking, came to the same conclusion ourselves. As in the offseason, we were trying to come some way we could, you know, send Eric Gordon to Houston, and now Houston has Harden, so why do they need him?
Right, and, you know, Daryl Morey has been looking for a certain type of player, and he did a really good job, by the way, of setting up his roster so that he could have guys there and continue what he had, or he can blow it up real quickly, turn it into pieces that he could send for, you know, to land the whale if he had the opportunity to do it. And if that failed, then he had a lot of young talent to develop. So, you know, he really did a good job on that, and he went for the whale with Dwight Howard, and that probably came a lot closer than most people realized to actually taking place. You know, if Orlando had backed off a little bit, maybe on some of the bad contracts, then that deal would have gotten done and he would have gotten Dwight Howard. But, you know, plan B was, you know, once the Harden deal presented itself, he had the assets to be able to flip for a guy like that. But he was looking for centerpiece guys. He was, you know, he got a Cheek, he got Jeremy Lin. Now he's looking for that real go-to big-time scorer who was more of a sure thing. And I don't know if he would really have bitten on Eric Gordon or not. You know, Harden seemed to fit the profile for what he was looking for a lot better.
Yeah, we're looking at Toronto and all the bad contracts that Colangelo just keeps on throwing around and hoping that he'll welcome Gordon in. But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think he's going for somebody with that big of a deal at this point either. You know, he'd happily get rid of somebody like, you know, Calderon, but, you know, that's a bad trade for him in order to, you know, to acquire that big of a contract. You know, it's one of those things where it might become an untradeable contract. You know, Amari Stoudemire probably has, you know, even though the Knicks don't mind having him that much, you know, if they did decide to trade his contract, he's probably Amari Stoudemire is untradeable because it's a huge contract. He's got the injury history. He may not be, you know, be that kind of player anymore. And his contract is accepted from the lease insurance policy where if he does go out, insurance doesn't even pick it up. So, you know, Eric Gordon might be another guy who's in that same situation where he's just completely untradeable given the salary and given what he's going to bring up for.
Yeah, what the Hornets need to hope for is more Russian billionaire owners to enter the league.
Right.
You know, or you know, maybe the Orthokine, Regenikine treatment helps him, or, you know, something like that. You know, obviously plan A is to get this guy back healthy because he really has the potential to be, you know, a great scorer, a great player if he's healthy. And everybody wants to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. That was a great, Larry. Thanks for coming on. I really enjoy reading all of your Twitter responses to the questions you get hit with, particularly the responses that go on for three or four Twitter or tweets.
It's funny because they used me on NBA 2K13 this year, and I was one of the guys who's there on, you know, their version of Twitter feeding back feedback to players. And my comment was that, you know, on the court, the game looks totally realistic, but the Twitter stuff, it's so unrealistic because not one of my tweets stretched to more than 140 characters.
All right. So thanks very much for coming on, Larry. That was great.
Anytime, guys.
Thank you.
So that was fascinating. Eric Gordon has now moved. People think we're pessimists. Larry basically just called Eric Gordon untradeable. All I want to do is like curl up inside and fetal position and rock back and forth for a little while.
But see, to me, that wasn't the worst news. I mean, I feel that way. I mean, I'm the guy trying to trade him for Danny Granger, a guy who won't see the court for 3 months minimum. So I already felt that way. The part that bummed me out was the fact that, you know, the Hornets don't have the option to do the Nick Collison type extension with Jason Smith. And I didn't realize that, but looking back at Larry's article, it's true. You know, since it was only a 3-year contract, he can't do that. And I at least like that as an option on the table, but I guess we don't have it.
Yeah, I thought you were going to cringe a little bit at that, because that's like one of your little pet things. Or, you know, like every post you put up there, like, this is what we could do in the future. Jason Smith extension.
Well, yeah. I mean, to me, if the Hornets can't land a Brandon Jennings or a Josh Smith or a guy that I think is actually worthy of their cap room, that was a nice alternative to get another young guy on a rookie contract and then use that money this year to kind of front load a Jason Smith deal so that when the Hornets are contenders, he could have a small deal stretched out over 3 or 4 years. So to me, that was something that I was hoping for. The Al Farouk scenario is interesting as well. I mean, the Hornets will have significant cap room, but mm-hmm. what they can't do is essentially spend that cap room and then come back to Al Farouk Aminu and really work something out. What they can do is by,
well, wait a second, because he's, I mean, they can, but they can only offer him up to how much he's already making.
That's
supposed to make.
Yeah, that's if they keep his hold and his bird rights, which would keep about a $4 million cap hold on their books.
Right.
So let's say without Al Farouk Aminu, they have about $13 million in cap room. Let's say they throw that all at Brandon Jennings. Then what Larry was saying is their only choice is to come back at Al Farouk and use what is the room exception,
mm-hmm.
which is just, which is under $3 million in its first year, which I don't think brings Al Farouk back. But they could keep his bird rights. They could keep his bird rights.
Well, I got to challenge you on that. Like, a week ago, you were like, Al Farouk's not even a good enough player to pay more than $3 million to. And now you're like, well, Al Farouk, you can't offer him less than $3 million or he'll run away. So is your opinion changing here a little bit on
our... I mean, that's $1 million difference. He was a $3.75 million player, and this room exception is under $3 million. I'm saying a long-term contract cannot start there for Al Farouk Aminu. It's just an interesting situation. I mean, the good thing is they would have his bird rights. If they can't get a guy like Brandon Jennings, you know, they would have that. They would be able to pay him or do some kind of sign and trade. But yeah, I mean, you could really see where this Eric Gordon contract is really limiting the Hornets' options. And I think Larry's right. I think at this point, you know, just there's no way to get out of this contract. You got to hope that he comes back in 6 weeks, plays really well, and either stays playing that well and never gets injured again, or plays just well enough for some GM to say, hey, you know, we need a star. This guy could be a star. He's been healthy for the last 4 weeks. Let's trade for him.
Yeah. So I think we need to jump on to the last game that we saw, because Aminu once again looked good. So we've now seen, you know, 4 games of Al Farouk Aminu, or is it 5 now?
Well, the Hornets are 3-2, and he played in all.
Yeah, my brain's not working very well at the moment. So, 5 games now, and technically, he's only had one game where he wasn't great, but if you look at that one, he still had 16 rebounds in the game. It wasn't a bad game. It wasn't a good game, but it wasn't a bad game. So, Al-Farouq Aminu, if we get to the end of this season, you've heard our options. Brandon Jennings, we decide, isn't worth a max contract, because that's going to be the kind of stuff you're going to have to do to pry those guys away. Do you think we should, say, spend $4 million on Al-Farouq Aminu? Like, a 3-year, $12 million deal?
Yeah, I would look at like what the Spurs gave Danny Green as kind of a template. I would go plus or minus, you know, $500,000 to $1 million per year. But I think that's the type of thing. I mean, yet you say Al-Farouq Aminu has played good, and he played good in that Charlotte game, and I agree to some level. I mean, he made his dunks, he made his short shots. But again, you know, we saw times where he was taking 18-foot jumpers and not necessarily late in the shot clock. So, again, it's a very limited good that where, you know, he's doing the things that he should be doing, but he still is abysmal shooting percentage-wise whenever you take him out of that, you know, 4-foot in area. He still has a high turnover percentage. Again, this is a guy who led the league amongst wing players the last 2 years in turnover percentage, and his turnover percentage is actually higher than it was, you know, the years that he led the league in it. So, again, he's a good player at doing what he does well. I don't get too excited about it because if we're talking about the Hornets being contenders – when you are a contending team, when you're in the Western Conference Finals, teams know what you do poorly, and they're going to make you do that well in order to advance. I think people could take away a lot of what Aminu does well. So I still am not 100% sure he's a long-term answer, but if I could get him for a Danny Green type of contract, of course I would do it.
Okay. Yeah, good. So I was watching that game, and there was another player on the court who reminded me of Al-Farouq Aminu. And it was a guy I was really, really high on in this draft. Do you see the same thing from Michael Kidd-Gilchrist?
Do I what?
Do you see the same sort of thing about Michael Kidd-Gilchrist? That he's, at the moment, an Al-Farouq Aminu kind of player. He's all transition, all hustle and defense, but there's really no offensive half-court game there at all.
See, I Michael Kidd-Gilchrist could put the ball on the ground and take it to the hoop without looking completely clumsy the way that Aminu. If Aminu has to take more than 2 dribbles to get to the basket, more likely than not, something bad is going to happen. I think Kidd-Gilchrist could catch the ball at the 3-point line, you know, take it into the hole, maybe even make a move where he moves laterally, where, you know, Aminu is just, if he has a clear path to the hole or if the shot is created for him, he could finish. I think Kidd-Gilchrist is similar, but I would say with that one added strength of, you know, being able to put the ball on the ground multiple times in the half court and get to the rim. But I will say that right now, at this phase in his development, I would say Al-Farouq Aminu is the superior defensive player right now amongst the two, which might surprise some people because that's what, you know, Kidd-Gilchrist's, that's why he was drafted number 2 overall.
Yeah, well, Kidd-Gilchrist, I mean, and I agree, but yeah, Kidd-Gilchrist, is he even 20 yet? I think he's still 19.
Yeah, he's the youngest player in the entire league.
Yeah, so, I mean, you got to give him, Al-Farouq's been in the league a few years, give him that much time and we'll see who's the better
one. I have to give him anything. Anthony Davis is already a top 3 big, and it's his first year in the league, and he's just 19. And before
– So, Anthony Davis.
No, you're going to try. Before we get to him, you made me or tried to get me to apologize last week. The two guys who I said were not, you know, who I don't didn't fully buy into. They had, you know, three good games in a row, and all of a sudden they were quasi all-stars, so I had to apologize. A guy that you said on the podcast last week shouldn't even be in the league, should be sent, you know, back to Europe, has a game where he just absolutely goes off in 29 minutes. So gives you 16 points on 8 shots, gives you 8 assists to only 1 turnover. Now I must ask you, are you willing to admit that you were wrong on Brian Roberts, and is he a long-term solution after this one game against the Charlotte Bobcats?
I still think Brian Roberts is a replacement player, but I mean, I'll admit I was probably a bit harsh saying I wanted him off the team. But, I mean, the idea that he's going to be able to do anything similar to this consistently is, I mean, still completely ridiculous to me. And he's still, I mean, he is absolutely flammable. Ramon Sessions made him look awful defensively. And there was actually a play in his second possession. And I'm going to try to get that video and put it on the site. Although I thought about it. And thought, maybe I shouldn't do this because I'm just being mean to poor Brian Roberts. But they had, like, this ball movement. It was a ball movement set where it was supposed to go side to side. And it went down low, shot out to the wing, came around to him at the top. And if he just kept moving it, if he had passed it on to Darius Miller, who was on the wing, Darius Miller would have had an open shot, or he could have re-entered the pass. And instead he stopped, waved Darius Miller off, waited for the entire Charlotte Bobcat defense to reset up, and then he drove and tried to score. And he had basically got nowhere and ended up having to pass it out. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that, as a point guard, you should never, ever do. When you're running a set, let the set run to generate its ultimate goal, an open shot. Don't break it, unless you're LeBron James. And then if you break it, you go immediately, because the whole point of these sets is to keep the defense scrambling. And if you catch the ball and you stop and wait for a second so that your players can clear out so you can have more room space to move in, you've completely destroyed any advantage you've gotten.
Yeah.
But I will say that Brian Roberts looked fairly good offensively last night. He wasn't amazing, but he looked fairly good.
Yeah, see, I would want nothing more than the readers and listeners to turn their venom towards you, because I feel like it's always on me, because frankly, I take more chances in this podcast. You just play it safe. But
right.
But so I would love it, but I got to defend you on this one. And I want to do it because I want to preface it, because frankly, I don't want 3 weeks from now Xavier Henry to go 6 of 7. And then, you know, everybody asking us to apologize what we said about Xavier Henry and, you know, anointing him the small forward of the future. There, you know,
hey, Xavier Henry didn't miss a single shot last night.
Exactly. Didn't take one. But guys are going to have good nights. What people have to accept, at least in my opinion, is there's 450 players in the NBA. By the definition of the words good and bad, there has to be 90 to 120 bad players in the NBA relative to the other NBA players. Now, if Brian Roberts came to my gym, he would destroy everybody there. He would be a good player in that setting. In the NBA setting, like it or not, there's going to be 100 bad players relative to everybody else every year, and the Hornets aren't immune to those guys. Now, bad players are going to have good nights. To me, Brian Roberts was, you know, he was hitting his floater, and that's good, but every time I saw Charlotte hedge hard on him, I mean, he dribbles with his head down, so he would basically run into a trap. I saw him have to call a timeout once getting trapped. I saw him, throw a very lackadaisical pass that should have been intercepted. I saw him, you know, essentially have to come back to almost half court when he got trapped a couple times. I mean, he's going to hit floaters some night, but the traits and tendencies that he has are going to lead to 5 times as many nights, you know, similar to what we saw in the Chicago game versus what we saw in the Charlotte game. So just hold off before you bash my counterpoint, Ryan, here on this podcast. Though I will agree, maybe a little harsh that you should, you immediately wanted to send the guy packing. But I think your main point was that he was a replacement level player, and I completely agree. If he were to go out for the season tomorrow, the Hornets would be able to find somebody, you know, whether it's in Europe, the D League, or, you know, a former NBA player that's a free agent like a Sean Livingston that could come in and over the course of a season give you as much as Robert's going to give you right now. So I think your main point is still warranted, even though you're a meanie.
I am a meanie, but and I'm going to continue to be a meanie because let's talk about the reason why Brian Roberts had to play 30 minutes in that game.
Oh, here we go.
Grievous Vasquez.
Can you turn off the SAP on this podcast? Because I have a feeling that we're going to ignite some flames with some certain listeners.
Yeah, well, Grievous Vasquez looked awful.
Oh.
Awful's nice. He could not handle any of the pressure Charlotte was throwing at him. He could not get into the paint. There were possessions where the shot clock was down to 7 before Grievous Vasquez managed to put his foot on the three-point line. And they were doing anything they could to keep the pressure off of him. They were throwing the ball to Austin Rivers to try to let him get some pressure off of him. They had Brian Roberts in there for the same reason. The guard play on this is terrible, but right now it's starting with Grievous Vasquez, and it's very obvious that it is now entering everybody's scouting, that if you pressure Grievous Vasquez, the Hornets are in trouble because they can't get into their offensive sets. And it's such a shame because this Hornets front court is amazing, but Vasquez, he was not good. And, I mean, you can look at his line and apologize for it and say, yeah, he was 1-10, just a bad shooting night. And he still had 3 rebounds, 8 assists, and only 1 turnover. That's a really pretty solid thing. He's +9. But if you watch that game, you realize he was a major problem for the Hornets. And that's why Brian Roberts played 30 minutes.
And not even watch that game, but I watch probably an average good chunks of 3 to 4 games a night. I don't see any other point guards in the league get pressured like he does. And it's because of what you're saying. He's on the scouting report that this is a slow-footed guy who, if you pressure, you could take the Hornets out of their sets. You could get the occasional steal, the occasional trap, occasional turnover, bad pass. Like, I don't see any other point guards get pressured like this because, you know, even below-average point guards could handle that kind of pressure. And this is just a major major weakness for Vasquez that I just, you know, frankly, he's not going to improve his foot speed. I could only see this getting worse. I don't see, as Monty Williams, I don't see many ways to counter this other than to have Roberts or Rivers on the court, or Gordon if he ever gets back, have them bring the ball up, and then have Vasquez get it, you know, with about
15, in attacking 16, position.
Yeah, have him get it with 15, 16 seconds in the set. But even if he does that, he's going to have to go quick because as soon as the defense presses, you know, he's going to be flustered. So it would be a thing where Rivers or Gordon has to bring the ball up the court, get it to Vasquez in certain spots, like at the top, because you don't want him to be trapped on the sides of the wings, get it at the top and then have him immediately go into some form of pick and roll. I mean, it's just something where Monty is going to have to make so many adjustments because of his glaring weakness.
Right. And I mean, and I'll just say this. I mean, we've said this before. I'm not saying Vasquez is a terrible NBA player. He deserves to be in the NBA. He deserves to be a backup point guard, a primary backup point guard for some team somewhere. He just doesn't have the complete package to be able to be a starter night in and night out. And that's not like, I mean, I'm not doing the Brian Roberts thing, which is Vasquez needs to be on the bus out of here. I'm just saying we need somebody other than him at the reins for most of the game. And that is what's been happening the past few games, is they've been taking Vasquez off the ball as much as they can, except for in certain situations where his size helps him and his speed isn't a major issue. Like if he's being guarded by Jason Kidd every night, he's fine, because Jason Kidd's slow-footed too. But when he's going against, you know, Ramon Sessions is a quick guard. Kemba Walker, I was pestering him like crazy. And Walker's not known for his defense, but he was making Vasquez like 2 feet inside the half-court line have to turn his back and back the ball in because he couldn't handle Kemba. So I don't. It's an issue. We said it before the season, you know, started. This, as long as Gordon's not on the court, guard play is going to be this team's major weakness, and it is a major weakness. But the reason why it's not killing the Hornets is this incredible front court. So last night. Oh, and, you know, we're recording this Saturday, everybody, so sorry if you're listening to this Monday. We're recording this Saturday. Ryan Anderson, 25 points on 16 shots, hit 5 of 10 three-pointers, seven rebounds, two assists.
No moment, might I add. I predicted 5 threes, 29 points, and multiple offensive rebounds. So it was off a little bit, but you just felt a breakout game coming from Anderson.
Yeah, you knew it was going to happen because he's not going to be held down for as long as he had been. Our good buddy Anthony Davis, 23 points on 18 shots, 11 rebounds, 4 of them offensive, 2 assists, 2 steals, 5 blocks, 1 turnover, 2 fouls, 37 minutes, complete Tim Duncan game.
Yeah, yeah, and the free throws were a little... you know, after going 9 of 9, you expected better. People don't realize how hard this is to do. I'll tell you, this was the hardest shot for me as a player. 2 of Anthony Davis's missed free throws came after that little melee, which I think was a flagrant 1 on Byron Mullins. And
you're calling that a melee?
It's a minor. I mean, come on. There was 12,000 people in attendance. I'm trying to get people to go to games. So if they're into boxing or MMA, maybe we could get that crowd up. But 2 of those came with nobody on the blocks, and I don't think people realize how much harder that is as a free throw. I mean, free throw. You're just accustomed playing your entire life to having, you know, a visual perception, you know, at least, you know, of a couple guys in front of you as you shoot those free throws. So I'm not going to give them a complete free pass. I'm just saying that I expect more nights going 9 for 9 from the free throw line than 5 for 9.
But the best part about it is that's 9 free throws. I mean, and he has consistently gotten to the free throw line as a Hornet. Last year, the Hornets didn't have a player who got more than 4.5 per game. And the player before that who got a large number, you'd have to go all the way back to Tyson Chandler, and Tyson Chandler got fouled because they didn't want him to dunk. So he is the first player on this Hornets roster who is consistently getting free throws in the flow of the game. And that is the number one way to give yourself nice, efficient points is the free throw line. So
can I rattle off his per 36 minute stats, which I think he's going to play 36 minutes a game.
Sure. Go right ahead.
So we got 23 points a game, 11 rebounds, 3.6 blocks, which basically would have been right there with Ibaka last year, for leader in block shots per game, 1.8 steals per game, which this is something that in my what to expect when you're expecting pieces, I think a lot of people underestimated his impact. I think he could easily be a 1.5 to 2 steal per game guy, something that, you know, people always think about Olajuwon being such a great defender because of block shots, but he actually ranks extremely high, you know,
in steals.
I think this could be, I think that Davis could be 3.5 block, 2 steal guy in his prime, which, I mean, if you just think about what that creates for the Hornets, that's fantastic. He's shooting 53%, 78% from the line, but again, that's down. And then what we saw in college, and this again is what I said could help the Hornets defense improve so much. He is averaging less than 1 personal foul a game.
Yeah.
I mean, that's insane for a guy who, again, is making 5.5 major defensive plays a game between blocks and steals. He's making 5 high-impact defensive plays a game, and that's not even all the shots he changes, and he's picking up less than a foul a game. That's just remarkable.
Yeah. He's – and what's the best – well, I don't know about the best. The most amazing part about it, and the reason why I'm calling him like mini Tim Duncan now, is he does it with very little flair. I mean, can you, other than the one alley-oop, can you think of like an amazing
dunk that I was like, Anthony Davis brought the house down.
There was one that I've just, I couldn't believe. He, it was the one from Vasquez. It was a 3-on-2 break. Vasquez flipped it back to him. And he got hit and didn't get very high in the air because he got hit early in his jump. But, you know, laid it up with his left hand. And that's what, I mean, Jerry V came on last week and we said, what would you work on? And Jerry V said the righty and lefty hook. We saw a beautiful righty hook in that game. But we also saw two plays around the basket in which he used the left hand and it looked as fluid as the right, you know, with a 19-year-old, I think his ability to score around the basket, which again, I think everybody takes as just a given, but it's not. I think his ability to score in different ways around the basket is already at a super elite level in the NBA.
Well, let's just rattle down the list of moves we saw from him last night. And keep in mind, okay, Robin Lopez has been in the league, you know, for 4 years. He doesn't have most of these things. You can rattle down all the different big-time centers, and most of them you're not going to find have this complete package. Bynum doesn't have it. I mean, Dwight Howard clearly doesn't have it. So what we saw was two off-the-dribble pull-up jumpers, one of them fading sideways. We saw him take Byron Mullins and once Michael Kidd-Gilchrist off the dribble and lay it in over them as they contested strongly. We saw a gorgeous dump down to him where he took one dribble and went up with the right hook and hit it, I mean, dead on. There was nothing but net. We saw quick hits where the ball moved around and he knew all he had was like a half second of space, and as soon as the ball hit his hands, he laid it up. We saw him drive and hit a lefty scoop shot. I mean, this is the kind of plays that guards do. He had a complete set of offensive moves last night, and he's finishing them. It's crazy that he can do this, and it's not what you saw in college. I will say, 100%, in college, you saw him show a couple of these things, but he didn't put his entire arsenal on display most of the time, and he's showing it all. And I can't say enough. He's amazing.
Yeah, and if anybody hasn't watched it, they have that all-access show with Kentucky on Wednesday nights, my wife's favorite show, which it's great to be a husband where I don't have to watch, you know, the Real Housewives or the Bachelorette or whatever. My wife's favorite show is this all-access Kentucky, and Calipari keeps going back to it of how Davis had those skills, and, you know, he took the fifth most shots on the team. You see this new guy, Nerlens Noel, coming in, and Calipari talks a lot about Davis because there's some comparisons there. And Calipari just says, you know, it's not fair to this kid. Davis was a once-in-a-generation type guy. He sacrificed for this team. He had all these skills, and all he wanted to do was win. So, you know, I think it was there, and the fact that it was there and that Davis, you know, put that away in order to do what was best for the team. I mean, guys like Deron Lamb needed shots because they were – you know, they were guys who couldn't do much else to help you win. So if they're not taking shots, they're not helping you win. The fact that Davis put that away to sacrifice for the team, I mean, yeah, I'm ready to see, after coming up that podcast with Larry Kuhn, I'm ready to see if we could sign him to that extension today while he's loving it in New Orleans. I want him locked in for the next 9 years.
Right. So, but let's talk about the side effect of Anthony Davis playing so amazingly. He had 37 minutes. They pretty much had him out there as much as they possibly could because he kept getting whacked in the eye.
Yeah.
And having to go back to the bench.
And again, not to keep plugging my wife, but she's like, wait a minute. Doesn't he have millions of dollars? She just kept yelling out LASIK surgery the entire game. And it's true. Why are these guys wearing contacts? Get the LASIK, Anthony.
It doesn't work every time.
I think that he thinks the laser might take off some of the unibrow, so he's a little afraid, but get the LASIK.
So the side effect of Anthony Davis playing his 37 minutes at Ryan Anderson and still getting a little low with 28, Jason Smith, 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think
that's... He pulled him out, and Monty pulled him out at one point, and you saw his face, and he had, like, a kind of irritated look on his face, like, you're calling me out on that? Do you?
Do you see a problem here?
I see a problem. It's his thumb. I think, you know, we saw Monty sit Rivers out an entire game because of a finger, you know, and Rivers didn't want to sit out. I think Jason Smith probably begged him to play in this game, but obviously the thumb was injured. He's still not 100% from the shoulder. I think this was purely Monty saying, look, we got this game. We got this fluke game from Brian Roberts. I'm going to ride Davis, Lopez, and Anderson are killing these guys. We don't need you tonight. What we need is 100% from you through the rest of the year. I think it was purely injury, but I know what you're talking about, and it actually coincided with Anthony Davis. Davis had the problem with the contact, put Smith in, and then once Davis got that settled, he ran back out there for Smith. But I think this was purely an injury thing that, again, if Jason Smith got to call his own minutes, he would have been out there 15, 20, 25. Monty saw that this was a game the Hornets were going to win, and there was just no need to risk any further injury on a guy who's a kind of nicked up right now. So I think this was purely injury preventative and related. I do not expect to see 5 minutes from Smith ever again when he's healthy, but I am concerned that we're only going to see 12 to 14.
All right. So Robin Lopez, was he a positive or a negative in that game?
On the boards, I would say positive, but again, he didn't get any offensive rebounds against a team that is the worst in the league in giving up offensive rebounds. I guess net overall, I would say negative, because again, when Anderson and Davis is in, that's as elite of a 4 and 5 offensive combo in my mind as you could have in the NBA. So now we're talking about, well, then Lopez is coming in purely defensively. He did a good job boxing out, grabbed 7 rebounds in just 26 minutes on the defensive end. But the Bobcats put him in those pick and rolls, and, you know, he just that's where they got a majority of their space from. So overall, I would have to go with a negative, only because I'm imagining if Lopez wasn't there, would the Hornets have played better on this night? And I think increased minutes for Davis, Anderson, and Jason Smith in this particular matchup would have had better results for the Hornets.
Yeah, I had a hard time. I mean, I think Lopez does a lot of good things, and I can see. I actually know why Monty's starting him. But you're right. On the pick and roll defense, he's not good, and it's that also is appearing in people's scouting reports now, where he's being put consistently into that. And it didn't burn us. It burned us a lot later when Ben Gordon was flying around. He was able to start leaving Byron Mullins wide open, which, you know, Byron Mullins gone 6 from 10 in the game, in his last game, from 3-point. Maybe that's not the greatest thing in the world.
Right.
So it could have burned us even more, because he only went 1 of 5 last night. And clearly he was, Byron was off after he, you know, got into that MMA fight with Anthony Davis. Davis put a sleeper hold on him. Laid some knees and, you know, worked his body. Then Mullins couldn't hit the three anymore. But it could be worse. I think Robin Lopez, and I really hope it becomes this way, really needs to be situational. And hopefully the person he's trading more minutes with is Jason Smith. But there was that article out on ESPN about Anthony Davis and maybe we should play him at the small forward. And while I like the idea, the reason why I like the idea is so that we get Jason Smith more minutes. I don't like the idea of Anthony Davis on the wing, and I'll be 100% honest. When I watch him go out on the wing to defend quicker players, he's slower than them. He gets beaten. Anthony Davis is a freak athlete, but he's not Kevin Durant. I mean, the idea was, oh, Kevin Durant played shooting guard. Well, the difference between shooting guard and small forward is very negligible. The difference between a big man and a wing is huge. And he's a big man. And while I think he's not going to be embarrassed if he has to cover them situationally on the wing, I don't think that's what you want him to be doing. So I don't know if I really like the idea of him playing much more than like 4 or 5 minutes at small forward at most.
Yeah, I mean, again, with that, I don't really know what we're talking about. I guess, you know, offensively, see, small forward is different in every offensive set, you know, what they're asked to do. So I guess we're not talking offensively. We're just purely talking
defensively.
Yeah, and I don't want him out there, even though we did see, I believe, two of Davis's blocks came on the perimeter yesterday, which is so impressive. I mean, that's just so rare. But he blocked Ben Gordon twice, seemingly the only two times that Ben Gordon missed all night. But, yeah, I completely agree. I love the Anderson-Smith Davis lineup, though, and I guess you could say whoever's playing the three there. But I think all three of those guys could switch on pick and roll. I mean, they could effectively – all three of those guys could cover or at least, you know, not be embarrassed by anybody at the 3, 4, and 5. So it would allow them to switch, cross-match, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The thing with Lopez, I agree, situational. You know, as the scouting reports continue to come in, I believe that we're going to see the offensive numbers go down, where he's a putback slash dunk type of offensive player. I don't expect to see, you know, the bevy of post moves or jumpers that we saw in the first couple of games. And the other thing about Lopez is, and this is the thing I loved about Chris Paul, and I know it's not fair to compare Chris Paul to Lopez, but any time that there was it might be a little unfair, but I mean, any time that there was a 50-50 ball, if it was in the ground, if it was in the air, if it was two people tied up, you knew Chris Paul was coming away with that 50-50 ball. Robin Lopez gets rebounds, but it seems to me, at least, that every rebound he gets are the ones that come to him where he boxed out, which is, you know, which he should. But if there's ever a 50-50 ball, if there's a long rebound, or if it's an awkward angle and he has to move it all for it, I feel like he never comes away with those 50-50 balls. And to me, I think Jason Smith is the consistently the better rebounder when it comes to, you know, movement laterally, those 50-50 balls or whatever. I love Lopez as a big body, and he takes up enough space to where when those balls come directly to him, he snatches them. But I just think that we're going to see production start to get back to the norm of where he's been the last couple of years as the season goes on. And I hope that Smith's minutes, I would love to see both him and Smith getting between 18 and 22 and one guy getting more depending on the matchup. But I don't want to see this formula where Lopez consistently, no matter the matchup, no matter how he's playing, gets more minutes than Smith for the next 77 games.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I think you're right. I think if David Thorpe was on this podcast, he would say that Robin Lopez is not a specialist at rebounding out of his area, and that there are rebounders who do that. I will say Jason Smith is not an impressive rebounder to me for all of his athleticism, all his hops, all his hustle, and the fact that he does get in there and knock the ball out of people. He's actually – his results aren't spectacular as a rebounder, but you know at least he's going to be, you know, making people work really, really hard all over the court for them.
Right, so. And I think this is why we see Smith and Anderson are such elite – or not elite, but very – I mean, to me – fantastic offensive rebounders, but not fantastic defense. I mean, Jason Smith's offensive rebound percentage last night, which I know was just 5 minutes, but was 48.3, which is, I mean, it's absolutely insane. If you look at Mason's posts on Saturday, that shows you what's, you know, elite, what's good, what's, I mean, it's insane. But the reason it is because offensive rebounding is more effort and you could be more aggressive. Where defensive rebounding is more passive. You got to find a guy, you got to box him out, stay in your location, and essentially you're just playing a more passive role. So Smith and Anderson you know, love being aggressive and love being active, they're always going to be better offensive rebounders than defensive ones where that just doesn't, you know, completely translate.
Okay, so I do have one final point about that game before we move on to the previewing the upcoming contest. This is where I think the Hornets got killed a lot last night, and again, it's our guard play. Our combined guards, Brian Roberts, Roger Mason, Grievous Vasquez, Austin Rivers, combined 6 rebounds. And what we consistently saw over and over and over again were we would force the Charlotte Bobcats into a long-range attack. The ball would come off long, and their guard got the ball, or their wings got the ball, every time. They beat us to those long rebounds all the time. And it was because our guards weren't getting to them. We got to do something about this guard position.
Yeah. I mean, Ben Gordon shouldn't get 3 offensive rebounds in a week, let alone in one game.
Right.
That's it. I mean, that's not his game at all. And I mean, the Bobcats had 15 total offensive rebounds in that game. I agree. Something has to happen.
They had 15 offensive rebounds and they only missed 43 shots.
Right.
And that's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, that's an offensive, their offensive rebound percentage was 35.7 last night.
Which, if, I mean, look at Mason's post, but 35.7 would have led last year's league by like 4%.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's just unacceptable. I agree. The other thing, after seeing probably his best defensive game in Chicago, I was completely disappointed with Rivers' effort on the defensive end. I mean, there were shots where he didn't even contest. Like, and that's something you could get away from and away with in college. You're playing Maryland. You got a guy who you're guarding is going to be an insurance broker in 3 years. You could afford to just be in his face and not put your hand up, maybe yell something at him. He's going to break the shot. Ben Gordon, that's just not acceptable. I mean, that the play on the defensive end and defensive rebounding, you know, was just absolutely awful. And it, to me, it's mental. It's these guys are obviously thinking about the offensive side of the ball. Once their guy or somebody else shoots, they're already transitioning there. And, you know, they're just not finishing possessions defensively the way that I know Monty would want them to. And it's going to catch up because the schedule does not get much easier.
All right. So we have a long layoff again. So the next game is Wednesday against Houston. We get to see the phenom James Harden. I mean, Jeremy Lin, because, you know, isn't he the real phenom? So this terrifies me, after especially seeing last night's game against Charlotte, where we're going up against Houston, which has one of the most explosive scoring guards in the entire league in James Harden. And Jeremy Lin is not bad, as much as people, you know, want to not give him credit. He's actually a pretty solid attacking guard. So their strength is their offense from their backcourt. And our weakness appears to be our defense and our backcourt. Does this bode well?
I mean, I guess the layoff could give Monty some time to do some things. I mean, the Hornets only used it for one play. And again, it was when Davis had to go out with a contact issue. Get LASIK, Mr. Davis. But they used a matchup zone for one play against the Bobcats and Ben Gordon when he was getting really hot. I think that there's maybe some creative things to do, especially when you don't have to worry about front court scoring. I mean, you don't have to worry about a sink at all.
Well, did you notice for probably 5 plays from the very end of that game, Monty had switched Aminu onto Gordon?
Yeah, I don't know if he has the lateral quickness to do that with Harden.
Right.
Again, I wouldn't mind seeing Harden and Lin going off for 50 points. What worries me is them getting into the lane and getting other guys hot.
Yeah, together they're combined for 11.2 assists per game. And Parsons on the wing is getting almost 5.
Right. So to me, that's the thing is if Harden and Lin are driving the lane and they're not getting easy buckets for Patrick Patterson or Marcus Morris, or even we saw when we played the Rockets in the preseason, Carlos Delfino was getting open three looks and just absolutely draining them. You know, not getting Omar Asik easy buckets. So I would almost concede, you know, big scoring nights from Harden and Lin if we didn't, you know, allow them to get other players buckets in that course. I mean,
So the San Antonio way of doing things, where when they would go against the Suns, they were pretty much let Nash shoot and score all at once as long as we shut everybody else down.
Exactly. And you know, Harden did start off crazy hot. He's really cooled down lately. And for the best backcourt in basketball, which I just wanted to rip my eyes and ears out when Yahoo and ESPN were both proclaiming Harden and Lin the best backcourt in basketball. Right. Oh, that drove me nuts. For the best backcourt in basketball, those two guys combined are averaging 8.2 turnovers a night.
Yes. Yeah. They're turnover machines.
So, yeah. So, go ahead.
Harden's got five a game.
Get your buckets. Try not to foul Harden, which is, you know, much harder to actually do than say. But, I mean, he's only shooting 26% from three. Lin is at 29. You know, turn these guys into chuckers. Let them get their shots. What I don't want to see happen is, you know, Patrick Patterson, Marcus Morris had one really nice game so far this season. I don't want that, you know, him to have a second against us. Omar Asik, I guess I wouldn't mind if the Rockets exploited that matchup as long as the rest of our team isn't helping out. And then, you know, Delfino's getting open looks at three, or Patterson and Asik are dunking at the basket.
All right, so here's the – we've talked about what their best advantage is against us. Where do you see our greatest advantage is offensively against them?
I couldn't imagine any lineup that Houston could put out that could defend the Davis-Anderson duo. Now, see, this is exactly where Monty's got to go against Norm, because there is no reason for Robin Lopez to play significant minutes in this game. He, you know, Asik could be defended by Anderson or Smith because he has no offensive prowess. So
shooting 40% from the floor, and they're all at the rim.
Right. So there is absolutely no reason why Lopez needs to log significant minutes in this game, where if you flip it around on the other end, you know, Asik chasing Anderson or running out on Davis, you know, who's faced up on him, or, you know, chasing Smith on the pick and pop, like, you know, Asik can't cover that. I just can't see any 4-5 combo in which the Rockets are going to be able to deal with those three guys. Now, if Monty puts Lopez in and then Lopez is just on the block and is basically a non-factor, you know, against Asik, or they just cancel each other out, then, you know, to me, you're not taking advantage of your biggest strength. So I would love, love, love to see Smith, Anderson, and Davis get the majority minutes in this particular matchup with 15 to 18 going to Lopez. I do not expect to see that at all, but to me, that would be where our massive advantage lies for us.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Asik, his one huge ability, I mean, it's been – people talk about his defense. I mean, that man's averaging in 33 minutes almost 14 rebounds a game, 5 offensive rebounds a game. That's a pretty crazy set of numbers. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, with his guards shooting, there are a lot of offensive rebounds to get, because James Harden's shooting 44%, Lin's 38%. Carlos Delfino takes a lot of shots. He's at 38%. Chandler Parsons takes 10 a game. He's at 40%. There's not a lot of efficient offense going on here, and he's cleaning it up. But that is the only reason why I would see Monty might try Lopez try to keep Asik off the boards. I don't know if it's going to help. And I agree, offensively, if you play Lopez, you're allowing Asik to do what he needs to do, which is stand by the basket, guard a non-factor, and be able to help with his great defense on somebody else, and then vacuum in the boards. So,
exactly. And the other startling thing about Asik to me is a guy who doesn't get the ball much on offense, no low post moves, you know, barely touches it. How is he averaging 3.6 turnovers a game?
because he's being stripped.
Yeah, I mean,
he gets the rebound and
the rebound gets stripped. The team misses. He gets another rebound, so he's stacking his rebounding total.
It's like Moses Malone. He told reporters once that he padded his offensive rebound stats by purposely missing layups so he could jump up on the other side, grab it, and put it back.
It's fantastic.
it's like Kevin Love in his interview with Simmons. You know, you always read these things and you're kind of like, really? Because he was talking about how he got his rebounding numbers so high, because you don't see numbers like in the 14s, 15s. And he says, well, one of the things you do is when the ball comes off the rim at the end of a quarter, you leap up, grab it, and then you glare right at the statistician so that they give you that rebound. Even if time expires, sometimes they'll still give it to you.
Oh, yeah, those and then the missed free throw ones. Those are the
two. Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, he has a turnover percentage of 30.1, which is just – I mean, we told you how many turnovers Harden and Lynn average, but both of those guys are below 20%. Asika's at 30.1. I mean, this is just
the team is averaging 19.8 turnovers per game. Generally, 19.8% of your possessions is horrible. They're actually having that many turnovers, and their possessions is probably like in the 90 range. So that is like astronomically awful.
And another thing to watch for in this game, like the Hornets, the Rockets simply do not put people on the free throw line. So this will be, you know, one of those games where the Hornets are going to have to earn their points, where they're actually going to have to hit from the field. I don't expect them to get to the line very much, and you know, hopefully it goes both ways. But with Harden, with Harden by himself averaging 10 free throws a game, I think it's going to be hard to keep him off the line. Wow.
Oh, that was bad.
Yeah, I didn't mean to do it, but it was just there for me. But, you know, as much...
I groan at more of your jokes than I think anybody else I know.
but again, this is a team where supposedly they have the best backcourt in the NBA. Think of them as an offensive team, but their offensive rating is 26th in the league, while their defensive rating is 10th. I mean, they do not have superb defenders, but again, they keep people off of the line with a seek on the boards. They keep people off of the offensive glass. You know, they're just pretty much average in every defensive category, with the exception of they don't let people get to the line. So because of that, again, they're a top 10 defensive team. So as much as we identify this team with James Harden and perhaps Jeremy Lin, they're actually, you know, playing and winning games, the two that they've won, with defense more than they are offense.
Okay. Everybody's healthy except for Eric Gordon. Who takes this game?
I believe.
That doesn't sound that firm.
I want to see Monty prove me wrong. I think he's going to be stubborn and stick with Lopez. I think because of that, this game is closer than it should be, and I think Houston has a closer where the Hornets don't, so I see a four-point victory for Houston, but I'm dying that Monty proves me wrong and limits the minutes for Lopez in this game, because I think the other three have such an advantage.
Yeah, I have a really hard time calling this game because of that backcourt matchup so brutal. But I believe our front court matchup is just as good the other direction. I'm saying the Hornets take this one on the road in overtime.
Ooh, really going out there.
That's right. And it's gonna be a frustrating overtime game, because the Hornets will be ahead and Houston will come roaring back and tie it.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I would agree with you if you could, if Monty and I could sit down and he could promise me that he's going to limit Lopez's numbers in this particular matchup, but I don't think that's going to happen, so stick with it.
All right, so we'll be back middle of the week to talk about what we see in this Houston game. We'll also have previews for the Oklahoma City and Milwaukee games, which are both kind of interesting to me, OKC being OKC and Milwaukee having your superhero Brandon Jennings on it.
Superhero, and thanks so much to Larry Kuhn. Guys, if you have any follow-up questions for him specific to the Hornets situation? I mean, obviously, we'll try to answer them, but if it's something that we don't know or we're even the littlest bit unsure of, we will email Larry and get any of your questions answered. So please throw any questions you might have in the comments box right below where you call Ryan stupid for whatever he said in this podcast.
Right. Or you can make Mike apologize.
Never!
Thanks for listening to In the Know. Bad to all me, the land of red games.